I was born in Egypt a long time ago.
Very long time.
Thank you, David. And I was telling I forgot who I've been telling, telling a lot of people. I come from a very, very, very mixed family. The origins of my paternal side is from Syria, which started in Egypt. People from Aleppo came to Egypt before Napoleon invasion, so it was about 1785. And a young man was born there. I even know his name. It was called Joseph Siufi, and he was taken in the army of Napoleon. And when Napoleon evacuated Egypt after the defeat of his army, this young man found himself being taken to France. With him was a young girl from Egypt. I even know her name. She was a Christian. She was called Teresa Tutungi. There's a very large family Tutungi in Egypt. Huh? And they got married in France. And that would have been the end of the story. And they got married in France, and they had many children. And they formed a whole dynasty in France. But one of them, for the bad luck of Zahi Hawass, one of them came back to Egypt. A boy called Jean-Baptiste. In fact, he was 40 years old, and he married an Italian. An Italian woman who was born in Egypt. I know she was from Trieste. I even know her name. She was Anna Maria Nordi. There you are. And they had 10 children. One of them, a girl, is my grandmother. She married a Belgian. They had one son. That's my father. And he married a Maltese. And that's me. So if you're wondering about my accent, that's the explanation. To be honest with you, I mean, although I was born in Egypt, I came from a family that did not think about Egyptology at all. Really, there was no Egyptologist in my family, and nobody was talking about Egyptology, and I trained as an engineer. I'm a construction engineer. And I worked as an engineer. I went to England when I was a young man. And I started working in engineering. I had really nothing to do with Egyptology, other than, like you, being interested in pyramids. And I took jobs, because I speak Arabic, I took jobs in the Middle East, and I went to work in many places in the Middle East. I'm not going to bore you with details, but I finally ended up in Saudi Arabia. And I was working in Saudi Arabia in the city of Riyadh as a commercial engineer. I was now 34 years old. Again, nothing to do with pyramids and Egyptology. And I took a trip, and I went to Egypt to see my mother. She was still living there. And it's one of those strange things that happens in life. I decided on the way to Alexandria, because my mother lived in Alexandria, I went on a flight to Cairo, to stop at the Cairo Museum. The famous, which you all know now, in Tahrir Square, the Tahrir Revolution. And the year was 1993. And this is where it all begins. It all begins for me. I entered the museum with a camera. In those days, you could. I had, by the way, I had one of these Olympus OM-1s. I don't know if you remember these. Great cameras. And I had a black and white film in it. You had one? Ah, you're my age then, huh? Yeah, these were the first slow shutters cameras, in case you're interested. And I took a picture of a painting, not a painting, a photograph on the wall. Let's see if I can get it. There you are. Now, it's the first time for me to have seen an aerial photograph of the pyramid. Now, it sounds strange to the younger generation, but I'm talking about before faxes. And this is before the internet, before satellite. So this was rather unusual for me. And it so happened that because I was trained as a setting out engineer, you know, the young engineers were on the street and they have the theodolite and they measure and they align roads. And that was my training. I was considered very good at this. And it doesn't take much to see that there is a strange layout. I'm going to go very fast here because this is not really my talk about, but I just want to set the basis of this. To cut a long story short, what it boiled down to is that I got interested in this plan because I was working in the desert in Saudi Arabia, and what I saw here was not at all what Egyptologists had been saying, that one pharaoh came and then another pharaoh came, Cheops, Khafra, and Menkaura, and they built pyramids one after the other. I saw a plan. I saw, because it looks like a plan. You know, you have three pyramids, that's already an indication, and two pyramids almost the same size. But the thing that bothered me was the smaller pyramid. The smaller pyramid and why it was offset. And if it was a plan, then there had to be a reason for this plan. And I couldn't find any. I looked into books. I became obsessed with it. And I took the picture to Saudi Arabia. I gave it to many of my engineering friends, surveyors, quantity surveyors, structure engineers, and they all asked the same question. Why is there a smaller pyramid offset? What is the explanation that Egyptologists give? Well, there was no explanation for the offset, but there was some explanation for the smaller pyramid. The Egyptologists say that the pharaoh, Menkaura, who built the smaller pyramid. Now, it isn't a small pyramid. I mean, to be honest with you, it's a 65-meter-high pyramid. But when you put it next to the two others, which are 146 meters high, it looks small. So everybody who goes to Giza says, oh, two big pyramids, one small. Why would this pharaoh want to advertise forever that he built a small pyramid? I wouldn't like to be the architect to tell him, sorry, but we're going to build you a small pyramid because you're not as important as the others. It didn't work for me. What worked for me is that this was a unified plan. It was all one plan. There was no big or small or one pharaoh, two pharaoh. It was one design plan, and there had to be an explanation. Anyway, I'm going to move very fast here. Whoops. I began to look at the pyramid texts. It's the only source of information we have about the ideologies and belief systems of the pyramid builders. Now, one of the odd things, there are many, many odd things about the Giza pyramids. They're big, we don't know how they lifted the blocks. We don't know their age. There's a whole confusion about the pharaohs who did them. But one of the very strange things about them is that they do not contain any inscriptions. Nothing. Except the graffiti that you saw, which apparently is a bit in doubt now. That, to me, is a mystery. That, to me, is a mystery because the Egyptians love writing. You go and visit Egypt, and the temples are full of writing. In fact, the pyramid texts that I was mentioning earlier are of the following dynasty. This Giza is the fourth dynasty. The fifth dynasty and the sixth dynasty built pyramids, smaller ones, but full of texts. In fact, put together, these texts make about 2,000 so-called readings. That much. A lot of texts. In fact, if you go in these pyramids, the thing that strikes you is that all the walls are filled with texts. So why no texts? in these monuments. And the question has never been seriously considered by Egyptologists, other than saying they didn't want to put texts. Now, I don't care if you're a pharaoh, I don't care if you're the pope, I don't care if you're the president of the United States or David Rowe. If you're going to build the Great Pyramid, you'd want people to know about it. At least your name, not a graffiti hidden. The architect would want you to know who did it, right? It's a very odd thing that it doesn't bother my friends, the Egyptologists, except David. No, David is fine. To ask these questions. There's a problem here. There is what we call in science an anomaly. You just don't brush it aside and say, well, no, we have to find answers to anomalies, because it is anomalies that change the world. You know, when people ask a question about something that seems strange, there is no answer to it, and he looks for the answer. You know the story of, well, Copernicus, you know, found an anomaly. Newton, you know, the apple falls on his head. He says, well, why did it fall? Well, here was an anomaly, I mean, a very serious anomaly. But what we know, at least from the pyramid texts, is that these texts speak of the stars. They're full of references of how the king undergoes a kind of very complex ritual, a metamorphosis of his body, and becomes a star spirit. And to the stars, he travels. And he travels to very specific stars. And the stars that are nominated in the pyramid texts as his destination is the stars of Orion. So very clearly, there had to be a connection. And I'm going to jump here, but the connection was this. There is an explanation for that strange plan. I'm going to stop here. I did this for people who didn't know much about my work. But to be honest with you, I didn't know what to do with this at the beginning. I thought, what do I do? I mean, do I publish it? Do I write something about it? You know, I was working as an engineer. I finally contacted a whole series of Egyptologists. And, well, typical answers, as you probably know, David. You know, thank you very much for your letter, but, you know, it's very interesting, but goodbye. I don't think something wrong here. I mean, aren't they seeing what I'm seeing, you know? I finally got a letter from the late, he's now dead, Sir Ivan Edwards, who was the expert on pyramids. And not only he was very interested, he invited me to see him, but he said something I did not know. He said that there was a shaft in the Great Pyramid that pointed, at the time of construction, to Orion's belt. To me, that was the clincher. It was beyond coincidence. I wrote a book about it. I published it in 1994, and the next thing I knew, Egyptologists, archaeologists, philologists, everybody who had an ist after his name, jumped on my head. They didn't like this theory. I'm still very confused why they didn't like it. I thought I was doing them a favor. I thought, you know, a new idea, you know. But then they all said, well, what about the other monuments? You know, what about the Sphinx, for example? I mean, what about the Sphinx? This was 1996, and at that time I had made contact with another very well-known researcher now, a man called Graham Hancock. You hear about Graham Hancock? Yeah. And Graham Hancock had the same publisher, and we met. And I gave him something that I didn't want to mention in my first book, because I thought they were going to get in trouble. I mean, already they don't like me for this. But I told them that I could demonstrate that the Giza necropolis, using the astronomical analysis with the Sphinx, formed a celestial image of a period long, long before Egyptologists are willing to consider, of 10,500 BC. And this period is not just taken from the air. They speak in their texts, and David Rohl spoke about it a little bit, of a period called Zeptepi, the beginning of time, the first time. And they associate this first time with the coming down of the gods, particularly the god Osiris, who created the Egyptian civilization in their creation mythology. And I thought, wait a minute, if Osiris is considered to be a god of the first time, and he's represented because the constellation of Orion is supposed to represent the god Osiris, maybe these stars have a first time. This is one of those moments in life, in case you come across a situation like this, where you're going to take a leap outside the box. You're going to go against the grain, you know it. I mean, I was talking about the correlation, what you saw before, fourth dynasty. They didn't like the idea, but okay, at least I was in the same period. But now going to 10,500 BC was going to be really taking the whole challenge. And I remember discussing this with Graham Hancock, and do we do it, do we don't, and he said, let's do it. And let me tell you, hell broke loose. We published a book called Keeper of Genesis, and it was a number one bestseller. I want to advertise my books, in case you want to. And it caused pandemonium. Egyptologists, in fact, nearly, not just Egyptologists, but a lot of scholars hate this idea. They hate the idea that civilization, as we know it, could be much older. It puzzles me. I like the idea. I like the idea that we have a much older pedigree, that we belong to a much more ancient and more noble civilization. Anyway, that's it. That's my work. Because we were talking about the Great Pyramid, the Khufu Pyramid, and because Dominic and Stefan audaciously retrieved those samples and moved on, if anything comes out of this, of what they did, there's going to be a lot of debate, as you know it. There's going to be a lot of... You're going to have the same ists on your back. Believe me, it's not just calling you. You're going to hear all sorts of names. I mean, I've been called... But I knew that I had something. And you know when you have something is when you get them upset. You know, when you really get them upset. And believe me, not just everybody upset, I got the Minister of Antiquities upset. I mean, really angry with me. And I know it's good stuff. Because that's how it's begin. It's a kind of inquisition. But the good thing now is they can't burn you. So they insult you, they criticize you, they attack you, they call you a cheat and whatever, but they can't burn you. And we're still here, and they're very upset. But if anything comes of this, you have raised a question, and that is so important, because raising a question, because there is an anomaly here, they should not, according to Egyptologists, have had iron at the time, which I find very, very strange. Let me go in the next picture. Oh yeah, that's me. Since I talked about iron, the pyramid texts are full of iron quotations. The bones of the king, when he becomes a star, are made of iron. A lot of statements. The throne of the king, where he sits on in his celestial realm is made of iron. They knew about iron, there's no doubt about it. And of course, there is this famous piece of iron that was found outside the southern shaft of the king's chamber, which is for sure contemporary with the monument. Egyptologists, I can tell you one thing, it was found in 1837. Nothing really happened. There was a report which you've seen. And then it went into a drawer. I forced the British Museum to bring it out again. The pictures that you saw with the hand, that was me. And we forced them to reconsider this. I will show you many other artifacts that have been found in the pyramid. We know they were there. We know their origin with the pyramid. And they have not been published. They have not been tested. Now that in itself is a mystery. That in itself is a mystery. Because you would think that anything found in this monument, because this monument, when it was opened, at least in semi-modern times, it was totally empty. There was nothing found in it. Not just no writing, but zero. It's one of those very annoying monuments. Because it's the biggest monument. It's the most perfect monument. It is the most talked about monument in archaeology. You'd think that anything that was found in it, or testing some samples, would be very interesting instead of all these accusations and politics and rubbish. Well, needless to say, I know the pyramid. I've lived many, many years literally in front of the Great Pyramid. In fact, I wrote a book there. There's me, writing my book with the pyramid outside. I'll tell you something very strange when you live outside the pyramid. After a year or two, I began to realize I used to go on the balcony. There was a balcony facing the Great Pyramid. And I began to realize that I would go in the morning having my coffee and I did not look anymore at the pyramid. And I realized that everybody down in the street were not looking anymore at the pyramid. And you know why? Because every time you look at it, there's all these questions that come in your mind. Who built it? Why is it there? When? How? And the rest of the day, you're thinking pyramids. So you stop looking at it, really, unconsciously. I'm serious, it's very strange. It is a monument that defies your logic. It's one day you wake up and you think, maybe the pharaohs. And another you wake up and you get this feeling that it shouldn't be there. It's just so strangely there. It sits there, dominating the whole of the scene. You can see it from miles away. You can see it from 25 kilometers away. I don't know if you've followed this, but there is an astronaut in the space shuttle who actually took a picture from the space shuttle. Okay, he used a magnifying lens. And he actually mentioned that they look like Orion's belts, strangely enough. Anyway, you've heard about its interior design. I'm going to go very quickly here. There is two chambers in the substructure inside the monument itself. But the most bizarre thing in terms of construction is these things, the so-called shafts. Now, you'll find them mentioned here and there in Egyptological books. Sometimes they don't even mention them at all. Well, let me tell you, it is the most difficult thing to build inside a monument like this. Very, very difficult. Imagine your house. I mean, you live in northern or semi-northern Europe. Presumably in the old days you had chimneys. You know, where you fire, you put the fire in the chimney. Well, imagine putting a chimney stack going at an angle through your building. And the architect is going to think you're mad. It's a crazy design. Well, this is what they did here. Let me show you how these things are designed. Oops. Well, we know that two of them are aligned to the stars, but we'll skip stars. Oh, there's a nice graphic showing Orion and the star Sirius, by the way, the star of Isis. By the way, I believe that the pyramid does have a language, but it doesn't have a written language. The architect who designed this is using what I would call a sort of astronomical language. I think I'll say something at the end of this. He's using, strangely enough, we'll see right at the end, a kind of universal language. He's using mathematics and astronomy. We'll talk about this in a bit later. Anyway, now about these shafts. The ones in the king's chamber, the one in the upper chamber, go right through the monument. And nobody knows when they were open. Were they open all the time, outside and inside? We don't know. But the ones in the queen's chamber, nobody knew they existed, because they were not open either on the outside or the inside of the chamber. You could not see the opening of the shafts until this man here, that's his two sisters, his name is Wayman Dixon. It's a very rare photograph, by the way. I managed to get this from his great-granddaughter, Wayman Dixon. By the way, it's either crazy Germans or crazy British who studied the pyramid for some reason. This was one of those crazy, a bit like Howard Weiss, who decided that he was going to investigate the pyramid. And he had a hunch, a very clever hunch. I mean, I'm surprised that nobody thought about it. He said, well, if there are shafts in the upper chamber, maybe there are shafts in the lower chamber. So he knocked on the wall and he heard the noise, and sure enough, he found the opening of the shafts in the queen's chamber. He even put his date, 1872. This is a picture taken probably in the 1920s or 30s. Now, you'd think, this is the one that really puzzles me with the scientists and Egyptologists and archaeologists, you'd think that it is so tempting to find out what's in there, right? I mean, you find a hole, you open it, and it goes God knows where. You want to know what's inside, right? Well, not so for our friends, the archaeologists and Egyptologists. They totally ignore this. I mean, it's quite amazing that it took till 1893, from 1872 to 1993, for another German, Rudolf Gantebrig, who explored the shaft. And they did the same thing as they did to you, Dominic. Instead of saying thank you, oh, they took him to court and they wanted to, oh, the usual mess. Okay, here's the shaft today. It's been cleaned around. This is the northern shaft. Northern shaft, and he found another one on the southern wall. There you go. But, of course, in those days, there was no equipment, there was no technology. So they tried to put some rods and woods. They even shot bullets with their guns to see how far it goes. They lit fires to see if there was going to be smoke coming out. And then they gave up. They gave up because that was it. And the whole story kept very quiet until our friend Gantebrig came. I'm showing you the size of this shaft. This is, I think it's my hand. And this is the opening. You can see that this block was actually uncut. Now, why would they do this? Why would they build the shaft? Here is the southern shaft. Because it's a very complicated construction. You have to lay a slab, ground, a floor, at an angle. Then you have this block which is cut like a U in reverse. And then you have to dress it. You have to put all this around it to catch again the courses of the pyramid, to bring it back to the courses. Now, why would they want to do this and not open it, not show it? It's a huge question. Well, the only person who thought, yeah, let's find out, is Rudolf Gantebrink. Rudolf Gantebrink, who, by the way, has phoned you, no, recently? You spoke to him. Rudolf Gantebrink, very strange, nice man, but very, oh, he's so German. Oh, Rudolf Gantebrink, he wants things to the millimeter. Ah, no. Very nice. Actually, I like him. You know how he got there, by the way? Well, I've written a book about this called Secret Chamber, in case you want to read the whole story. But he's another one of these. He doesn't care about rules. He doesn't care about politics. He doesn't care about all the games that are being played. He cares about trying to find out, like a proper researcher should, you know, to find out what the answer is. So anyway, he proposed to the German Archaeological Institute. At the time, it was run by Professor Rainer Steidelmann, to clean the shafts of the King's Chamber. And the reason is that Zahi Hawass had asked Rainer Steinman to clean the shafts, and Rainer Steinman did not want to spend any money. And he had this document from Rudolf Gantebrink saying, I would like to explore the shafts. So he said, okay, you can clean them, and then maybe, inshallah, we'll let you explore them. That's what he's doing now. He's cleaning the shafts. I met him exactly a week, before he started the exploration with a second machine. He called it Whoopawet 2. Whoopawet 1 was a very primitive cleaning machine. And he's about. This was the 7th of March. You know, I'll tell you something very strange. We met, well, I had an introduction by Professor Edwards, who was still alive. So he couldn't refuse, Steidelmann could not refuse introducing me to Gantebrink, and we met at the Mövenpick Hotel, maybe you know it. And he said something very strange, and I always remember. He said, you're the only person who is interested in my exploration. No Egyptologist is interested. Nobody came to see me. I mean, I don't get it. Anyway, he started exploring on the 7th of March. There we are. We're in the Oktoberfest, by the way. You know, very tired. He was very, very tired. He went through a lot of problems with the Egyptian authorities. Anyway, here is his machine. And you know the story. He found this door, or what looked like a door, at the end of the southern shaft of the Queen's Chamber. Now, the reason I got so entangled with this is not because we met. The Egyptian authorities did not want him to publish the story. They told him, no, leave it, we'll decide the right time. He got very upset with this, and he called me, because I told him I knew Professor Edwards in London, and he said, what do I do? So I said, well, I remember he called me on the 1st of April, and he said, I found a door inside the shaft. Now, you know what the 1st of April is, I don't know. So I thought, you know, he's German, but maybe he's making a joke, you know. But he said, I'll send you a video. I filmed the whole thing. So I said, great. Now, in those days before the internet, he had to put it with FedEx, and I got it. Actually, it was DHL, make publicity. And I got it, and I took it to Professor Edwards. And this is, I love this moment of history, because Professor Edwards was beginning to get blind. He was now 84 years old, and he would read with a very, very big magnifying glass. And I had to describe to him what was happening. And I said, well, you know, we can see a robot going in the shaft, and it's going up, and it's going up, and it's going up. And my God, there is a door, or what looks like a door. And this old man, who had been studying the pyramid for 70 years, jumped like a rabbit on the TV screen with his magnifying glass and turned to me and said, has it been published? So I said, no. He said, when did he find this? I said, 2 weeks. He said, 2 weeks? The media is going to go crazy. You have to announce it right now. You can't hold a discovery like this. What are they thinking about? So we put it, excuse me, we contacted, he introduced me to the Times. Now, the Times didn't believe it. They said, it's like the tapes of Princess Diana, you know. So they said, you've got to show us the tapes. Ganterbrink was very adamant, no, don't show it to anybody. I want it to be published in the newspaper. We finally got the Daily Telegraph, and we fell on this archaeological correspondent, I'll never forget her name, it's Christine McGurty, and she took 7 days to decide to publish it, and she published it on page 7, and the title was, I'm quoting exactly, it said, Robot Finds Portcullis. Robot Finds Portcullis. No mention of the Great Pyramid. So nobody read it. So I said, this is not right. I mean, I'm sure there's a lot more interest. We finally got the Independent to publish it on the 16th of April. And let me tell you, that's when hell broke loose. Every single newspaper in the, in the world, I'm not joking, from Alaska to Timbuktu published the story. Probably here in Germany, you heard a lot about it. It went absolutely viral. If it went out now, it would have been on the internet like crazy. A door in the Great Pyramid. Everybody was interested. Everybody except the Egyptologists. They got angry. They got angry. Why did you publish and it shouldn't have been published and you shouldn't call it a door? Well, how do we know it's a door? So it looks like a door. Well, you shouldn't. It's speculation. So I called Ganterbrink. I said, they don't like us calling it a door. He said, well, okay, we'll call it a slab with metal handles. So they didn't like that too. Said, well, how do you know it's a slab with metal? Well, okay, well. So finally we called it the thing, you know, not to upset anybody. That's how ridiculous was this dialogue. Now I don't listen to this anymore. We tried to please them and they got angry and they wanted to take us to court and they would have crucified me, believe me, if they could. So, there you are. There's the famous handles. Now, you'd think the first time ever, other than this piece of iron, that we find a piece of metal that is sure, absolutely sure, to be contemporary with the monument. This was closed, both sides. It's 100% sure. You'd think that they would want to test it, right? To know what it is. To this day, we don't know. To this day, we don't know if they've tested it and where the handles are. There's one of the piece, the handles that had broken off. You can see it here. We don't know if it's been retrieved. We don't know where it is. This is incredible. I find this very bizarre, to say the least. But there's more. This is a metal rod that was probably put in 1930 by, again, two British explorers. And they abandoned. They abandoned because they had these rods and they tied with screws and they pushed and they tied. And this is in the northern shaft. In the northern shaft. And they pushed inside. And they eventually hit a wall. They weren't quite sure what it is. And they stopped. Here is Ganterbrink taking his machine all the way up the northern shaft. The first thing he found was a very strange piece with two holes in it. Just keep this in mind because you see where it comes from. And this metal rod was pushed and curved into a corner. Then they couldn't push it anymore. The shaft turns. But what Ganterbrink saw, whoops, was this. This is an original piece of wood, probably a measuring rod. I can tell you why we are sure of it. You'll see in a minute. A measuring rod. Wood inside the Great Pyramid, surely contemporary with the monument. Perfect sample for carbon dating. We don't know where this wood is. We don't know if they've tested it. We don't know where it is. We know nothing. Surely there's a problem here. That's in 1993. This is Professor Edwards, by the way. You probably recognize him with his wife. They're both dead now. And Gantebrink and I, we went to present this. Well, he went to present this. I escorted him to in Paris. There's a very cute story. Professor Edwards was very, very interested because we invited all the top Egyptologists. There was Jean Leclan and Jean-Philippe Loer in those days. But he was very keen because Paris, especially Saint-Germain-des-Prés, was where Edwards and his wife had their honeymoon. And they wanted to have another honeymoon when they were 84. I thought it was very cute. Now, unknown to Gantebrink, unknown to me, unknown to anybody, back in 1872, Wayman Dixon found artifacts in this shaft, in the southern shaft and the northern shaft. You think that everybody would know about them. Seriously, read any book before 1993 in Egyptology, and nobody talks about these artifacts. Now, maybe Wayman Dixon did not tell the Egyptologists. That's possible. But he did. He actually tried to sell the artifacts to the British Museum, and they refused it. He even published in the London Graphic. London Graphic was one of the most popular. It was like the Spiegel. They still did not talk about it. I got to know that the Astronomer Royal of Scotland, it's a long story, Dr. Herman Brook, by the way, you might be interested, Dr. Herman Brook, a German, became the Astronomer Royal for Scotland before the war, before the Second World War, and he married a Scottish woman called Mary Brook, who was also an astronomer. I met them both. He died a year after I met them. She became a very good friend of mine. And she had studied the diaries of Piazzi Smythe, the Astronomer Royal, who had paid Wayman Dixon to look inside the pyramid. And she found the diaries. And she found that there was a hook and a piece of wood, which probably broke. You'll see, actually. Let's go a bit further. Now, this was 1872. It took 100 years, I'm not joking, till 1972, when there was the Tutankhamun exhibition in London, for the great-great-granddaughter of Wayman Dixon to remember that her great-great-grandfather had a box, a cigar box, and he had artifacts. And she took them to Professor Edwards in 1972. This is the writing of Wayman Dixon. Granite ball and bronze hook found in the small chamber from Queen's Chamber in the Great Pyramid. There's no doubt about it. You'd think that they would have published. Nope. Forgot about it. It took another 20 years, till 1993, for us to catch the story again and look for these pieces. So I went to the British Museum and said, where are they? Where are these pieces? They said they don't exist. You know, Professor Piazzi Smythe was a bit crazy. And it's a long story, but believe it or not, they were in the British Museum. I forced them, after 6 months of investigation, to look in the vaults, and they had put them in a drawer. The only artifacts of the Great Pyramid. Well, let me show them to you. There. This is the... Mrs. E. Porters is the great-granddaughter of Wayman Dixon, and she gives these fragments, dollarized pounder and a copper implement, to the British Museum in 1972. They knew about it. They registered them. I cannot believe how disinterested they are to put them in a drawer and forget about them. So anyway, we finally forced them to look. They found them, and their excuse was, no, 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 we didn't lose them. We just didn't know where they were. You know, that's one hell of an oxymoron paradox, but that's their excuse. Anyway, Here they are. Now that is not copper. That is not copper. It is bronze. It hasn't been tested, but it's been looked at by many, many metallurgists just from the pictures. And if it's confirmed to be bronze, then we have another problem, because bronze isn't supposed to have existed, according to Egyptologists, in Egypt. You need to have tin to put with copper, and you create tin bronze. There is no mines of tin in Egypt, as far as we know. The nearest place would have been Cornwall in England. It's quite amazing. You'd think that this would make a sensation. To this day, they haven't tested it. What about the little piece of wood? Because what he found in the northern shaft, here it is, you can see there. Now, you remember the two holes that you saw in Gantebrick's photograph when he pushed the rod? They probably were the handles fitted. They probably were astronomical sighting instruments to look at the stars. They probably were that. There you are. Here is a drawing of the piece of wood. We have not seen this piece of wood. They found a piece at the bottom of the shaft, and the other piece, you saw it up there. This piece you're seeing is about this size. It's about 20 centimeters. It is almost certainly a ruler, a measuring rod. But it disappeared. It took us another 8 years to trace it, of all places, at the Aberdeen Museum. It's a long story, but it got to the Aberdeen Museum in a test tube, in a glass tube. I contacted the Aberdeen Museum. I said, great, we know it. You know you have it. We can carbon test, fine. I get a message a week later saying, we know we have it, but we can't find it. And now, 20 years later, they still can't find it. We sent them an email a few days ago. Now, surely there is a problem. Either in complete disinterest, or I don't know. I'm telling you these stories because they're not the only ones, Dominic and Stefan, who have been through this kind of strange adventure. That's why I got interested in them, because I wanted to explain to them. He says, no, really, you don't understand all this crazy politics going around, but this is the reason. Gantebrick, in desperation, gave his robot to the British Museum. He said, okay, they don't like me, they don't like what I say, you do it. I was there when the robot was given. This is June 1993. Nothing was done about it. Of course, many years later, we find that our friend Zahi Hawass has taken over all this exploration with the National Geographic. Here is their new robot, 2002. They drilled a hole in Gantebrick's door. They pushed a fiber optic camera and they found 50 centimeters away either another door or another block. Where is the handles, the copper or bronze handles? Where is the wood? In fact, where is the publication? We've heard nothing. I'll tell you what we've heard. When the story of Dominic broke out in the papers, there was another story broke out in the papers by the U.S. Department of Justice. They're investigating a bribery case between this man, Hawass, and National Geographic. And then they called me the bad boy. They found another door in the northern shaft. Obviously very similar to the Gantebrick door. This multiplies the chances of finding something interesting here. You Surely there is something. Surely there is, well, I don't want to speculate, but it certainly rouses the most catatonic, boring person. But it doesn't rouse our Egyptologist friend. Here they are, you can compare them. It is a very strange thing. I mean, we have no idea what they were doing, except that we know the shafts pointed to stars. What they had in mind, what they were doing, what they're hiding, what they're... we don't know. Then, just before the Egyptian Revolution in 2010, comes another team. This team is from Leeds University, and again with Zahi Hawass. And they have another machine. And they got the machine up, and they took pictures now with a fiber optic around behind the Gantebrig door. This is a graphic reconstruction, but I've seen the real pictures. The handles curve inside. Maybe to lift. This, remember the red ochre? They found red ochre markings. Here is a composite picture of these red ochre markings. There's a line here, and there's three images. It's been suggested, after a long discussion about them, that they represent three numbers. Is it right? I don't know. They're supposed to represent three numbers. If this is correct, and I'm not an expert, there'll be a lot of debate on it, but it represents, according to this research, the number 1, the number 20, and the number 100. 121. Now let me tell you what this means, apart from the fact that 121 is a prime number. It is the square root of 11 times 11, which is another prime number. We are now finding out that the whole coding of the pyramid, the architectural design of the pyramid, is based on two prime numbers, 11 and 7. When you find this in a monument so mysterious, so bizarre, asking so many questions with astronomical alignments, you ring a huge alarm bell here. I don't want to get into aliens and stuff like that, but there's something important here that is being coded in this monument. They've got to let researchers get into this. They've got to let people who know and have an open mind. There it is. Mysteriously sleeping and waiting. And in 1,000 years, if we don't do anything about this, they will think us very strange that after all this information, we did not bother to investigate. And thank you very much. I think I overshot my time.